this is your Polycast for Thursday, October 13th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, Governor Dayton says Obamacare is unaffordable for a growing number of people and improving safety at the security hospital in St. Peter. DFL Governor Mark Dayton acknowledged yesterday the Federal Affordable Care Act has serious problems. Tim Pugmire reports.
Dayton says the next president and Congress need to address the escalation of health insurance rates under the ACA. Minnesotans with individual market coverage purchased under the law will see premium jumps of more than 50% next year. Dayton, who's been a big supporter of the ACA, told reporters that he's also looking for ways the state can help.
The reality is the Affordable Care Act is no longer affordable to increasing numbers of people.
Dayton said he might consider a special session to take action before January, but he said he doesn't want to discuss that option with legislative leaders until after the election. Republicans have been using the issue against Democrats during this year's campaign. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And Governor Dayton also announced the creation of an advisory group tasked with building trust between law enforcement agencies and state residents. The council will consist of more than 30 members, including law enforcement officials and people who are critical of police tactics. Brant Williams has more.
The formation of the Governor's Council on Law Enforcement and Community Relations comes at a time when many people in Minnesota and across the country are expressing anger over the fatal shootings of African Americans by police. Dayton also noted what he called vicious and unwarranted attacks against police officers in other U.S. cities. The governor said most law enforcement officers do a good job making their communities safer and in maintaining good relations with the people they serve. But he acknowledged that challenges remain in communities where trust in law enforcement isn't as strong.
We need to face up to those challenges and to see what we can do to remedy them and move ahead, all of us as one Minnesota together.
The council will make recommendations to the governor and state lawmakers about actions that can improve police-community relations, as well as identify and publicize successful efforts by communities and law enforcement agencies from around the country. Council co-chair Scott Johnson is the chief of the Grand Rapids Police Department. He says police do a better job fighting crime when they get along with the people they serve.
For policing to be effective, there must be trust between residents and the police. For there to be trust, there must first be a relationship. And in my mind, policing is all about building relationships.
The council will consist of 15 voting members and 17 others who will participate but not vote. The governor has invited members of law enforcement groups to have voting roles, including the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, and the Peace Officer Standards and Training, or POST Board. Voting members will also include representatives from groups that have been critical of law enforcement and or have called for reforms in policing, including Black Lives Matter and the NAACP. Isaiah is a faith-based social activist group that will have a representative on the council. Communications Director Janae Bates says the council will not solve the underlying issues which contribute to the gap in trust between communities of color and police, but she says it's a good start.
Anything that can help with reform that is going to get us to a better place as a community, we are in line with.
Bates says the council should address policy changes on how officers are trained to use force and making sure police officers are more racially and ethnically representative of the diverse communities they serve. The council will also consist of representatives for the families of Jamar Clark and Philando Castile. The two African-American men were shot and killed by police in the Twin Cities during the last year. The Ramsey County Attorney's Office is expected to announce in the coming weeks if charges will be filed against the officer who shot Castile. The council will submit recommendations on how to improve police-community relations to the governor and legislature before the beginning of the 2017 session. And it's expected to present a final report next June. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News.
St. Paul's liquor stores will soon be able to stay open until 10 o'clock at night, Monday through Saturday. The city passed an amendment to allow stores to stay open longer yesterday. Right now, stores have to close at 8 o'clock Monday through Thursday. Council member Chris Tolbert sponsored the amendment.
It's one of those things where liquor stores still have the opportunity to stay open until 8 if they want to stay open until 8, or they could close at 3 in the afternoon as well, too. This just gives the option for liquor stores to stay open until 10 and also growler sales to go until 10 at the breweries.
But the longer liquor store hours aren't popular with everyone. Several smaller liquor store owners wrote in opposition to the amendment, saying the longer hours will bring in more overhead costs for staffing and require them to work longer days. They worry that the change will help bigger stores that already have staffing in place, such as Target, Trader Joe's, and Kowalski's. The new hours go into effect in November. Construction crews are putting the finishing touches on a major addition to the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter. The Department of Human Services says the $56 million expansion will replace part of the old building, and its modern design is much safer for both staff and patients. But as Matt Sepik reports, hospital staff say a lot of work still remains in terms of improving safety.
The Minnesota Security Hospital treats people civilly committed by state courts as mentally ill and dangerous. Some recent incidents highlight just how dangerous some of the patients can be. Last year, one slammed security counselor Kaya McMillan's head into a wall several times, then kneed her in the back of the head, knocking her unconscious. She still suffers from seizures and PTSD and has not been able to return to work. In early 2014, a patient entered the room of 41-year-old Michael Douglas, another patient, and stomped him to death. Hospital Director Carol Olson says the new wing will be much safer. Leading a tour during an open house yesterday, Olson stepped into a staff office on one of the units and pointed out the sweeping view of the common area and patient rooms. She says that's a big improvement over the current facility built in 1982.
They are having to monitor patients who are going down steps and around corners, up steps and around corners, around the corner, up steps and around corners, around the corner, down steps and around corners. They don't see the whole unit. You can sit in this staff office area and you see the whole unit. That's significant. That makes a big difference in staff and patient safety.
Olson also says the new building has several small two-bedroom units for the most acute patients.
So if someone is focused on trying to harm themselves, when you have them on a unit with 15 to 20 other people, it's hard to prevent what their peers are giving to them that they could use to harm themselves. When you're on a unit with just two people, you can control that a lot more.
Olson says there are other details aimed at making the building less institutional and more conducive to treatment, including skylights, soft linoleum floors, and units named for trees. Think willow and redwood, not 100 and 200. Even with the new building and its 104 beds, half of the hospital remains in the old facility with its blind corners and poor sight lines. Human Services Commissioner Emily Piper says Governor Mark Dayton plans to ask lawmakers again to authorize millions of dollars for new construction and to hire more workers.
Last year, he sought over $20 million to increase staff at Security Hospital, and the legislature didn't fund any of that request. And so he will be bringing that additional staffing request back to the legislature as part of his budget this coming year as well.
Piper says violent incidents and staff injuries at the hospital are down over last year. Last month, Minnesota OSHA imposed a $20,000 fine and settlement agreement on DHS for safety violations at the hospital. Tim Headley is a security counselor there and president of AFSCME Local 404, which represents hospital staff. He says safety conditions are improving slowly, but Headley says workers still aren't getting all the training they need, and they're too often subject to mandatory extra shifts.
We have the data. We have the documentation from other facilities that we're just not within the proper patient-staff ratios. Minnesota needs to be brought up to at least be competitive. You know, as this facility, the one and only in the state of Minnesota, we felt we were there at one time, and I hope that in our new future or in our future to come, we can be there again.
Patients are expected to move into the new facility in January. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Peter.
And that's your Polycast for this Thursday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.